This is a Crestview Bible podcast. For more information, visit crestviewhutch.org.
You've probably heard the definition of character in the following way. The character is how you behave or act when no one is watching. So that's what we would define character as, how you behave or act when no one is watching. And obviously the definition forgets that God is always watching, right? And especially in this always connected day and age that we live in, somebody's probably watching. But you get the point, right? Like how we behave and act in the moment, that defines our character. Character is seen or distilled or emerges when you act. That there's something you do, and as you do that, character is seen in how you function and how you act. Paul Tripp gave an unforgettable illustration, at least to me, to show how our actions come from our hearts. And he takes a water bottle that's full of water, takes the cap off and shakes it, and water flies everywhere. So there's just water all over the place. And then he asks, why did water come out of the bottle? And one answer is, well, because you shook it. That's why water came out of the bottle. But on a more fundamental level, the point that Tripp is trying to make is water came out of the bottle because water was in the bottle. A lot of times we want to say that the way we act or function when difficult times come into our lives is because those difficult people or those difficult circumstances have shaken us, and therefore we're kind of justified to act in a certain way. And what Jesus said, and what is the biblical way of understanding that, is no, what came out of your life was in your heart. It was already there. That's why it came out. It just took a shake to provoke it, to bring it out of your heart for the public view. So when the heat, when the suffering, or when the circumstances of life not going how you want to are turned up in your life, what comes out of your life in the way you act and behave? What character is seen? Well, we return this morning to the books of 1 and 2 Samuel, and specifically we're in 2 Samuel 1. You might remember the books of 1 and 2 Samuel are really one book. The reason they're split into 1 and 2 Samuel is because most scrolls weren't big enough to carry just like the entire book. So they had to break it somewhere. And this is where they broke it, in the middle of where we would see 2 Samuel 1. That's where the second scroll would begin. And I think we tend to think a lot of times that the books of Samuel are kind of really interesting because of the characters that are involved there, right? We've had some amazing characters as we've walked through 1 Samuel. We've seen Samuel himself. We've seen Saul and David, and they certainly propel the narrative forward. But the main character of the books of 1 and 2 Samuel is God. God's the one who is working throughout these books. He's the main character. He's the main character is the covenant-keeping God of Israel. The God is going to keep his covenant. He's going to keep his promises to his people throughout these books. And in 1 Samuel, the book began with us meeting Samuel. We're kind of introduced to him in the opening three chapters, and then we had an interlude about the Ark of the Covenant and some steps that they took that were wrong with that. On the heels of that, the people wanted a king, and God gave them what they wanted. We saw the rise of King Saul, only to see his quick decline, and then we began to see the rise of David, and 1 Samuel ended with the end of Saul's reign. That's how 1 Samuel 31 ended, with Saul dying. Now 2 Samuel is going to open with the next anointed king, David, assuming the throne in Judah and then in Israel. But first, David has to actually get the news of Saul's death. In 1 Samuel chapters 30 and 31, David had been distanced from the battle in which Saul died geographically, so some 80 miles away. Saul's dying while David is in the town of Ziphek. And in today's passage, David's going to be distanced from Saul's death morally. So he's not happy that Saul's dead. We're going to watch David respond to this tragedy as he gets the news that Saul has died. There's some helpful clues that are going to help us understand how we can have godly character in the midst of tragedy. So, what comes out of your life when tragedy happens? How do you respond when devastating news rolls in? Whatever that devastating news would be to you, as it rolls into your life, how do you respond? Today it may be very obvious that there's some work that needs to be done in our lives, and you may already be thinking, yeah, I don't really respond very well at all. So there may be some work that needs to happen. And so just prepare your heart today to respond. To respond to his word in ways that would demonstrate that God is your hope. That's what we want to show the world. That's what we want our character to embody, to show that God is our ultimate hope. For many of us, though, God is there just like an add-on. We forget that God's with us. We forget, like Psalm 23. We want Psalm 23 read at our funerals, but we don't live as if like it's a reality, that the Lord's my shepherd and he's with me. He's with me in the valley of the shadow of death, that his rod and his staff comforts me. We forget that when we're going through it. And so it's going to be good for us to think about godly character in the midst of this. And for those of us who are believers, he's promised his final words to us, right? When Jesus was leaving this world, what were his final words? Surely I am with you always, even to the end of the age. So he's promised to be with us. We can run to him. But I think a lot of us probably in this room, by the way we live, we don't believe that God's with us. We don't have confidence that he's with us. And so today, maybe you just don't have a relationship with God through Jesus. And if you don't have that relationship, what are you leaning into when crisis comes? What's your hope in trials when you're going through all this? What's your comfort? So there's a lot of stuff to fire our thinking this morning in this opening chapter of 2 Samuel, and I invite you to join me as we see two reactions that demonstrate our character in the midst of tragedy or crisis. Two reactions that can demonstrate our character. And let's read this whole narrative. We'll read 2 Samuel 1 in its entirety, and then we'll come back and make some comments and be done. So 2 Samuel 1, here's where we begin. After the death of Saul, when David had returned from striking down the Amalekites, David remained 2 days in Ziklag. And on the third day, behold, a man came from Saul's camp with his clothes torn and dirt on his head. And when he came to David, he fell to the ground and paid homage. And David said to him, "Where do you come from?" And he said to him, "I've escaped from the camp of Israel." And David said to him, "How did it go? Tell me." And he answered, "The people fled from the battle, and also many of the people have fallen and are dead, and Saul and his son Jonathan are also dead." Then David said to the young man who told him, "How do you know that Saul and his son Jonathan are dead?" And the young man who told him said, "By chance I happened to be on Mount Gilboa, and there was Saul leaning on his spear. Behold, the chariots and the horsemen were close upon him. And when he looked behind him, he saw me and called me, and I answered, 'Here I am.' And he said to me, 'Who are you?' And I answered, 'I'm an Amalekite.' And he said to me, 'Stand beside me and kill me, for my anguish has seized me, and yet my life still lingers.' So I stood beside him and killed him, because I was sure that he could not live after he had fallen. And I took the crown that was on his head and the armlet that was on his arm, and I have brought them here to my lord." And then David took hold of his clothes and tore them. And so did all the men who were with him. And they mourned and wept and fasted until evening for Saul and Jonathan his son, and for the people of the Lord, and for the house of Israel, because they had fallen by the sword. David said to the young man, "Who told you?" David said to the young man who told him, "Where do you come from?" And he answered, "I'm the son of a sojourner, an Amalekite." David said to him, "How is it that you were not afraid to put your hand out to destroy the Lord's anointed?" Then David called one of his young men and said, "Go, execute him." And he struck him down so that he died. And David said to him, "Your blood be on your own head. For with your own mouth you have testified, your own mouth has testified against you, saying, 'I have killed the Lord's anointed.'" Then David lamented with this lamentation over Saul and Jonathan his son, and he said, "It should be taught to the people of Judah. Behold, it's written in the book of Jashar." And he said, Your glory, O Israel, is slain on your high places. How the mighty have fallen. Tell it not in Gath, publish it not in the streets of Ashkelon, lest the daughters of the Philistines rejoice, lest the daughters of the uncircumcised exult. You mountains of Gilboa, let there be no dew or rain upon you, nor fields or of offerings. For there the shield of the mighty was defiled, the shield of Saul not anointed with oil. From the blood of the slain, from the fat of the mighty, the bow of Jonathan turned it not back, and the sword of Saul returned not empty. Saul and Jonathan, beloved and lovely, in life and in death they were not divided. They were swifter than eagles, they were stronger than lions. You daughters of Israel, weep over Saul, who clothed you luxuriously in scarlet, who put ornaments of gold on your apparel. How the mighty have fallen in the midst of battle. Jonathan lies slain on your high places. I'm distressed for you, my brother Jonathan. Very pleasant have you been to me. Your love to me was extraordinary, surpassing the love of women. How the mighty have fallen, and the weapons of war perished. This is God's word. Thanks be to God. So two reactions that demonstrate our character in the midst of tragedy. And first of all, we have to say at the outset that our character in tragedy begins as we respond with grief and mourning. We see this in David's life, right? His initial reaction. I think there's sometimes in the Christian world especially, we tend to think that when tragedy hits, we have to quickly tie up all the theological knots into bows and make it look real pretty when tragedy strikes. Maybe when tragedy strikes, we feel like we have to capitalize on a point that we feel like is really important to know at this time. And that's not what David's doing here in this moment. The shift is in David's heart, and you see this in his immediate reaction in these opening verses down through verse 12. So we have the death of Saul. That's how the book begins, right? Look at the first verse there, the first phrase, after the death of Saul. These are fitting opening words to 2 Samuel because David wasn't there. He'd been busy striking down the Amalekites, rescuing his wives, helping the people and sharing the spoil. For 2 days, in these opening verses, we're told he had remained in Ziklag, some 80 miles south of Mount Gilboa. So it's not like David can just pop out his smartphone and check Twitter. Like, how's the battle going? He can't, like, log into Facebook and message someone and say, how's the battle? You know, what's happening? There's no Ziklag news running news stories of a Philistine victory. So on the third day, we're told here in verse 2, on the third day, look, a man came from Saul's camp and has every appearance of, like, coming straight from the battle, right? He has clothes torn and there's dirt on his head. He has the appearance of being sad. And he falls on the ground before David, which should immediately cue us that this is something weird. We haven't seen anybody like fall on their face before David yet in all this, in all these books. In 1 Samuel, we didn't see that. So he falls on the ground before David and pays homage, which is just weird, right? You know, you just, hey, I got news from the battle. But first, let me come worship you. So we kind of know this is weird. Something's going on here. And David asks, where do you come from? And he said he had been at the battle. David wants to know how things ended up. And the quick report was the people had fled and many had fallen dead. And Saul and Jonathan are also dead. So again, the text is emphatic. Like if you look at verses 5 and 6 and 13, we're told that the young man who told him. And this is kind of the writer's way of saying, it's a little different story than what we know to be true from the narrator of 1 Samuel 31. And it's probably hinting by telling us it's the young man who's telling him this, that this story is not true. This is not how it went down at all. It comes into more clarity in verse 6. With the young man reporting that, listen to this language, right? By chance, I happened to be at Mount Gilboa, and Saul was leaning on his spear, and look, chariots and horsemen were close upon him. So these are all altered facts from what we know we've already been told about how the battle went. This isn't like challenging the fake news of the day. This is a report that we know is not true because we've read 1 Samuel 31. God wasn't deceiving us when he had the narrator recount to us what happened in 1 Samuel 31. These are altered facts. Chariots weren't driving up the mountain about to pounce on Saul. In fact, how did chariots make it up a mountain? I mean, it's an interesting deal. But according to this young man, he was looking around, and Saul was looking around, and he saw me, and he called to me, and I said, "Here I am." And Saul asked who I was, and I said, "I was an Amalekite." Again, this is another clue that he's one of the enemies that Saul was supposed to completely destroy back in 1 Samuel 15, and who David had just killed in 1 Samuel 30. And this young man says that Saul asked me to kill him, so I did it because I was sure he couldn't live after he had fallen. And then now the real point is, I took the crown, I took the armlet, and I brought them here to you, my lord. In other words, like, so where's my prize? Like, do I get a land all to my own? Or, like, you know, I'm just here, I'm your humble servant, you know, and here's the armband, and here's the crown for your head. This was his motive, I think, to curry some sort of favor with David by bringing him a crown. But if there's anything we learned in 1 Samuel, it's this. David doesn't need to get the crown by political maneuvering. He doesn't need the help of someone to, like, work it out for him. Like, he just doesn't need one of his generals to go kill Saul so that he can become king. No, David's trust is in the Lord. That God's going to make him king in his time, in God's time. So we know all, that's the whole background of the story. This report has come. I'm pretty convinced it's false. This guy coming to get something from the anointed king. But look at David's immediate reaction in verse 11. This is what is so interesting, right? After hearing all of that, David gets news that he doesn't say, "Well, thanks for that crown, and I think, you know, we'll start setting up shop right here." You know, David's immediate reaction is he took hold of his clothes and tore them, and so did all the men who were with him, and they fasted and or they mourned and wept and fasted until evening for Saul and Jonathan and for the people of the Lord and for the house of Israel because they had fallen by the sword. So we want David to immediately sort out all the facts, but he responds to the news of Saul's death with grief and mourning. He doesn't immediately deal with this Amalekite. He's going to deal with him in just a moment, and we'll talk about that in just a second. He responds with grief. He looks a lot like his greater son at this moment. And who's his greater son? Jesus, the son of David, the king of Israel. Jesus, when he walked on this earth, he looked at people and he shared in their sadness. He was full of compassion. There's a word that was used to describe Jesus a lot. Jesus wasn't quick to give a lecture or to fix people's wrong thinking about things. He just entered into their sadness with his heart. And we get clues for responding to tragedy in this. On Wednesday night, our students are studying Jesus and how to love like he loves. And last Wednesday, we look at the story of the woman of Nain in Luke 7, that Jesus raised her son from the dead. And here's how Paul Miller describes Jesus' compassion in that moment. He says, "Compassion is the emotion most frequently attributed to Jesus. And how can you tell that a person feels compassion? What did people see on Jesus' features in the scene? After all, compassion is quite subtle compared to anger or fear. When I ask people what compassion looks like, they say it's communicated through a person's eyes. They're soft and tender. Attentive, concerned. The entire body pauses and listens, absorbing the feelings of another. Perhaps Jesus stops mid-sentence and becomes quiet, transfixed, as he looks on this widow. Or maybe his eyes moisten and a tear rolls down his cheek. Whatever his reaction, it's noticeable, despite the commotion and distraction of hundreds of milling people." And that's what we see here with David, right? There's 1,000 things he could have asked, but he just gets the news. The people have fallen. We've lost in battle. Saul's dead and Jonathan's dead. And so he tears his clothes, mourns and weeps till evening. Responds with grief. And if you skip down to verse 17, we see that David gives, he voices his grief with a word of lamentation. We're told that David lamented with this lamentation over Saul and Jonathan, his son. And he also said it should be taught to the people of Judah. And it's written in the book of Jashar. We don't have the book of Jashar, but presumably just like a historical document that early readers of 2 Samuel would have known. Oh, okay, well that's where I can find it. Good. Now you may know lamentation, this language. Lamentation, you may think, well, isn't that like a book in the Old Testament, like 1st and 2nd Hesitations or something? You know, it's Lamentation, it's an Old Testament book. Yeah, it is. It's a book in the Old Testament, and it's true. But lamentation is a powerful way of expressing your emotions to God. It's a powerful way of expressing your heart to Him. There's a recent book that came out on this that really shaped my thinking a lot called Dark Clouds and Deep Mercy by Mark Vrogop. And he defines lament in this way. Lament can be defined as a loud cry, a howl, or a passionate expression of grief. However, in the Bible, lament is more than sorrow or talking about sadness. It's more than walking through the stages of grief. Lament is a prayer that leads to trust. Most biblical laments follow a pattern as God takes grieving people on a journey. And the poetic odyssey usually includes four key elements: an address to God, a complaint, a request, and an expression of trust or praise. Now, we don't necessarily have that template in this passage, but that's what we're thinking about when we're thinking about lament. So, remember, David was a songwriter. I mean, we think of him as like, you know, striking down Goliath, and he's this man's man warrior, but he's a poet. Like, he would be the poet laureate of the nation of Israel, right? He would be the one that would write the best songs. And he writes a song here to kind of give some structure to his grief, to kind of still responding with grief and mourning, and then to write a song and say, everybody in the whole nation needs to know this. This is what he's doing. And you can hear the refrain of the song in verses 19 and verse 25 and verse 27. It's how the mighty have fallen. And it's around this refrain that we hear residues of trust in God through David's grief. Even though Saul had sought to kill him, he continued to trust God. David continued to trust God and to honor the one that God had anointed as king. So David just has this reverence for God's anointed and what God had done. He even called all Israel to this lamenting. He says that, right? In the opening lines in verse 19, your glory, O Israel, is slain on the high places. And then nature's invited to this loss, right? So this is for the nation of Israel. It's not for Philistines to rejoice in. It's for the nation. And then in verse 21, nature's called to give an attention to this. And nature's invited to grieve this loss. In verse 22, we're talked about, the end of verse 21, these weapons of war didn't serve Saul and Jonathan well, but they're to be remembered well. This is kind of the trusting God for the realities that surrounded his anointed one. And again, kind of building out from that, so it kind of is getting inside and then we're coming back out. Both nature and the nation are invited to grieve. And then we get to verse 26, which modern readers seem to be particularly fond of. You type 2 Samuel 1:26 into the modern world, and everybody thinks, oh yeah, David had same-sex attraction for Jonathan. And it's obviously read with modern sensibilities. Nobody in the Christian world thought that until like 30 years ago. So you know that novel interpretation's really right? So for 1900 and whatever, we were on the wrong side of history, and now that's the right way to read it, of course. No, it just, the point that David's making there is just not that he has a physical attraction for Jonathan, but it's just, the verse is simply saying that unlike his wives, and think about how David's wives were arranged in that day, his wives were often arranged or for political purposes. We know that was the case for David, right? So David's first wife, why did he marry her? Well, she was Saul's daughter. It just made sense. What about his second wife, Abigail? Well, her husband was a bonehead, an idiot. And David kind of, God struck her husband dead, so David kind of like, I really need this woman in my life, you know, kind of thing. And then the third wife was another political alliance. Like to get along well with a neighboring country. Okay, well, I'll take Ahinoam as my wife, you know. So he's saying that his relationship with Jonathan was characterized by more integrity and more safety. I'd fought with him on the front line. I mean, it was David who had come and encouraged his soul in the Lord numerous times. So there's nothing like sexual weird going on here. This is just, hey, I really love this guy. My wives, I love them a specific way. I love this guy differently. That's all that he's saying. And I could say the same thing. I love the elders of Crestview and deacons differently than I love my wife. Does that mean I'm attracted to them? No. It's just saying there's a different love going on there. Not something weird. So I have to say all that because that's the day and age we live in, unfortunately. We can't just read the Bible and see the point that the writer's making. We have to go weird on it. So in this poem, for David then, his grief is moving from chaos to order. When the song just kind of sits down, okay, I'm going to structure my grief. That's kind of a way of what a lamentation is. I'm going to structure my grief. But there's no mistake that his immediate instinct is to respond in tragedy with grief and mourning. And what would it look like for you to have an instinct that when tragedy hits, you respond immediately with compassion? That rather than trying to make a political statement or rather than trying to tie up all the theological weirdities of a situation, you just responded with compassion. You just responded with grief. You responded with mourning. You lamented. This is what David has given us an example. And man, if our character was shaped this way, the world would notice. Too often the world, when tragedy or crisis hits, Christians are the people they don't want to hear from. Why? Because a lot of times we're just not stepping out in compassion. We're stepping out to lecture them on why they're wrong. Or we're stepping out to, oh, well, this is a point we can use for our political advantage. Or, hey, you know, God's going to work all this out. Rather than just stepping in with compassion. Of course we know those things are true, right? The fact that we can step into a situation like that with compassion, of course, the only reason we can is because we know God's going to take care of this. We have a trust in Him. But we don't have to go in and just lay all those cards on the table. We can just walk in with compassion, with grief, with mourning, with lamentation, and just saying, oh, this, God, what are you up to? You know, we look to you. That's kind of what David's doing. I think it's a great example for character because we're real uncomfortable in these spaces. You know, like we know, like when funerals come, we know what the right things are to do in those moments, right? But man, a lot of us are just really clunky in those moments. And I'm saying that's okay. Just be clunky compassionate. And it's going to be way better than being like some religious nut walking into the situation. Just clunky compassionate. Let's go for that. And that's what David, and even more so Jesus, shows us time and again. Jesus, as he walked on earth, this is just the default for him. He walks into these situations and you're going, doesn't he know like what he's stepping into? Well, of course he does. He's stepping into these situations so that his people can be marked by the same kind of compassion. So that we can read the Gospels and go, oh, that's how I'm to respond. So, grief and mourning. Well, secondly, one more point here, and it's in those middle verses 13 through 16. We react in tragedy and demonstrate our character as we hold firm on a desire for God's name to be honored. We hold firm on a desire for God's name to be honored. Now, some of you are going to use this second point to discount the first, right? Well, yeah, and you know, so that God's name is honored. Therefore, that's why I go in with guns blazing into those situations. No. It comes out of, like, compassion. This is like a deeper core into the onion, kind of. It has to go in tandem. Those have to go together. So, a firm desire for God's name to be honored. In verses 13 through 16, David responded with grief, obviously, but what about the young man who told him this? What happens to him? Well, David questions him, and he asks, "Hey, where do you come from?" And the young man answers, "Well, I'm the son of a sojourner. I'm an Amalekite." So again, I've hit these details a couple times, but it was the Amalekites whom Saul was told to totally destroy in 1 Samuel 15. And it's the Amalekites who attacked Ziklag and then were routed by David in 1 Samuel 30. Here's how Tim Chester puts it. Saul died because he failed to strike down the Amalekites, and so the anointed king of Israel is dead. And immediately David returns to center stage, and what's he been doing? Striking down Amalekites. And so the message is clear. David's the anointed one that Saul was not. And the problem with the Amalekite in our passage comes down in verse 14 related to the Lord's anointed. David asks, "How is it you were not afraid to put out your hand to destroy the Lord's anointed? How is it that you were not afraid to do this?" So David calls the young man to execute this Amalekite so that he dies. And David issues a judgment centered in the justice, in the God of justice he serves. He says, "Your blood be on your own head, for your own mouth has testified it against you, saying, 'I have killed the Lord's anointed.'" So some of us in this room, I mean, we have to come to terms with what's going on in this passage. And you might think, "Well, I thought you were saying this Amalekite was lying. Why should he be executed for this?" Well, then it's not too much of a stretch to consider that this young man died then for his false words and the content that emerged out of his heart. In other words, he would have killed Saul if he needed to. We know Saul died from suicide in 1 Samuel 31. The Amalekite didn't do the job. But his heart was bent on getting favor from David, even disrespecting, dishonoring the Lord's anointed. And neither David nor the God he serves would tolerate such treachery. So in the end, even in the midst of tragedy, even with all the bloodshed in this moment, David's holding firm in a desire for God's name to be honored. He will not allow God's reputation to be stained or his anointed to be disrespected. He honors God's anointed. We're told in maybe, there's wisdom books in the Old Testament, like Job, Psalms, Proverbs, Song of Solomon, Ecclesiastes. Right in the middle of those wisdom books is Psalm 111:10, and it's a verse that's repeated in almost all the other wisdom books, that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. And that's what's driving David here, a reverence for the Lord, a fear of him, living life before God's face. So again, the Latin term is coram Deo, before the face of God. You're living your life that way. And that's how we honor his name, even in the midst of tragedy. We hold firm that his name is going to be exalted. His name will be honored. So in conclusion today, we've seen two reactions that demonstrate our character in the midst of tragedy. We respond with grief and mourning. It's really a bulk of this chapter. And right there in the middle, holding firm a desire for God's name to be honored, even in the midst of that. So on one level, as we wrap up today, you might think, well, of course, grief and mourning need to emerge out of my life in the midst of tragedy. But is honoring God's name or esteeming him or honoring him something that you highly regard? I mean, think about that. Do you highly regard God's name, his honor? Maybe here's some examples of how you might not be. Maybe you think you can play fast and loose with the truth and it won't have ramifications for your life. Or maybe you just don't think about God being a God of justice. You just might think that God just is always just dishing out the good stuff, right? Like, here, oh, you want 100? Yeah. Who else wants money? I'm God. I'm good. You know, take it. And you don't think about God being a God of perfect justice. That he has to punish the sinners. Or else he can't be righteous. He can't be good. He can't be God. He has to be a God of justice. And this passage is bringing God's justice front and center. What might be one of the most important verses in the Bible is Romans 3:25. And here's what it says. That God put Christ Jesus forward as a propitiation by his blood. In other words, he put Christ Jesus forward so that all of his anger towards sin could be averted through Christ's blood. And then we're told that this is to be received by faith. And this was to show God's righteousness, or this was to show God's justice, because in his divine forbearance, he had passed over former sins. So what's going on in this verse? Well, it's just the problem. Forgiveness is a huge problem to God. You can't have forgiveness. God can't have forgiveness without something atoning for sin. And what atoned for sin was Jesus. Jesus' death on the cross atoned for sin. So by his blood, received by faith, God can look past your sin and give you forgiveness. And he can be perfectly just. So like if God was a perfect judge on the bench and somebody committed murder and God said, well, you don't really have a history of murdering, so I'll just let you go. I mean, all of us that vote for those judges, and we never know what's going on, right? You know, we're just highlighting, I'll just pick a bubble here, or I've been told by people, just vote no on all of them, they all need to go. And okay, well, or you vote yes, or we got to have justice somehow. But if we knew that this guy was guilty, and God just said, yeah, it's no big deal. Just let him go free. I'm a good guy. He wouldn't be a just judge any longer. He would get the reputation of being really easy. He doesn't take it very seriously, his job. And that's what he was doing for thousands of years. He was forbearing sin. He was letting it go. And something had to atone for all that sin, and it was Christ. So that God can be perfectly just. Perfectly just. Jesus dying on the cross for sinners was so that God's justice could be atoned for as he forgave sinners. And so, lest you think today, man, seems like awfully harsh of David. It's just pointing to something greater. It's pointing to this principle of the universe that God is a God of justice. And we thank God for that. And today, we don't have to be on the receiving end of that justice. We can escape it by trusting in Jesus as our Savior. That's such good news. We don't have to be punished. We can be free and trust in Jesus as our Savior. And today, we want to adjust our character in the here and now, because tragedy is going to come our way in some way. Someday it's coming. The tragedy might be death. It might be a horrendous disease. It might be the news of something happening that just takes us to the core. It may be something that happens in Hutchinson. You know, this year, I mean, think about all that we've dealt with and just how it provokes fear in your heart. We've had, you know, flooding in the spring. I think Cole mentioned this last week, you know, flooding in the spring and earthquakes and, you know, stuff's going to come our way. So let's prepare for it by responding, preparing our hearts to respond in the moment, right now. To respond with grief and mourning. To not quickly rushing into judgment or just glibly trying to make sense of it. like we're just avoiding grief at all costs. We're just saying, oh, you know, you're going to live to fight another day, and oh, this is going to be a better day for you or something. We come up with some cliche that we deliver as if, oh, yeah, what you're feeling means nothing in this moment. You know, eat, drink, and be merry. You know, tomorrow you die. So we step into that with compassion. We step into that with grief and mourning. We respond appropriately in the moment. And in the moment, let's hold firm a desire and hope that God's name will be honored. Just like David didn't have to give up honoring God's anointed, we don't have to give up the reverence of what God stands for in the midst of tragedy. We don't have to give that up. We hold firm to that. We're responding with compassion. And yet, on the other hand, we're holding up. God's name has to be honored in the midst of this. So let's hold firm to these realities. Because we long for the glory of God's name. Because we want to be a people who glorify and enjoy Him forever.